This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been just over a year since the oil tanker Exxon Valdez ran aground and spilled nearly 11 million gallons of crude oil into Alaska's Prince William Sound. Though more than $2 billion has been spent on the cleanup, oil still remains. Many birds and fish have returned to the area, but scientists agree that the long-term effects of the spill won't be known for years. My guest, Art Davidson, has just written a book about the spill called In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, The Devastating Impact of the Alaska Oil Spill. Davidson was the Natural Resource Planning Director for the state of Alaska and now writes articles and conducts studies on the land, wildlife, and native cultures of the state. He's lived in Alaska for 25 years, and he stays in touch with conditions at Prince William Sound.
I was in Prince William Sound last week, just the very tail end of May. And, you know, when you first fly over the sound or you land in a boat and you go among the islands, it looks beautiful. You know, the sun sparkles off the water and you have the mountains and the forest, and it just looks beautiful. And then you land your boat and you start walking up the beach, and even on the surface of the beaches, most of them look really nice. And then you start to turn over rocks and you find that the oil, this black gooey stuff, is still down in among the rocks. In places along the beach, it looks as if someone's done a poor asphalting job. There are patches and splotches it looks like asphalt. And what's happened is the oil that's in the beach during the winter, some of it has leached and sort of gurgled up. The tides have lifted it up, and it conglomerates and congeals with the little bits of shell and sticks and stones and so forth, and lays there in patches that look sort of like asphalt.
Is the cleaning still in progress?
Well, yes and no. Exxon has a cleaning operation, but it's nowhere near the scale that they had last year. And that decision, Exxon made its decision last year that they weren't going to spend nearly as much money this year, regardless of how the beaches looked. So this year, instead of 3,000 or 4,000 people out there, they have several hundred. They have small crews working with shovels. They'll shovel up if they find these patches of sort of asphalt-type material, they'll shovel it up in buckets, haul it away in a little cart, load it onto a boat, and it's shipped down to Oregon to a waste disposal site. The other thing that Exxon is trying to do, which is very controversial and which some scientists believe may cause, you know, enormous problems, is what's called bioremediation. You know, there are all kinds of small little microbes in the salt water. Some of them will digest and process to a certain extent hydrocarbons, you know, oil. Well, they're trying to stimulate these little bugs, these little microorganisms, by feeding them fertilizer, giving them a balanced diet, so to speak. And so this is the controversial fertilizing the beaches of Alaska program. Now, one of the problems is that the fertilizer is toxic, and where it's spread out, it kills some of the organisms that are still alive. And that might be a worthwhile trade-off. In other words, if you're really going to help clean up the beach for the long term, maybe it's worthwhile some short-term, you know, death of organisms. Well, some of the problems are no one can show for sure that fertilizing all these beaches, not, we're talking about hundreds of miles of beaches, no one can show that it's doing any good, that it's making a difference, that it's really helping the organisms digest oil. Some scientists are concerned that it may be creating a chain reaction which is going to come back and cause some real problems. So one of the things that really concerns me is that we're still being used as guinea pigs in Alaska. They're still experimenting and, in a sense, playing Russian roulette. They may create some problems this year that will haunt us for a long time.
Art Davidson is my guest. He lives in Alaska and is the author of a new book called In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, The Devastating Impact of the Alaska Oil Spill. You think that the spill and the difficulty in cleaning up the spill proves that the oil development of the North Slope was based on a false premise, the premise being that the oil companies could contain any spill. They couldn't.
Exactly. You know, we have been misled for years. When the pipeline debate was taking place years ago, in the early 70s, we were reassured. These people, the oil industry brought people in with their $1,000 suits, and they talked about all the precautions and all the state-of-the-art equipment and how they knew how to, you know, control and clean up an oil spill. We found out that they can't do it. after the spill, and some of, and within my investigations, I quote a highly placed oil executive, and he said, he confided to me, that a myth has been perpetuated, particularly on the people of America. And for years, this myth has been that the oil industry can control, can pick up a large oil spill. He said, we cannot do it. If you have a large spill, it's going to be out of control, and we have to face that fact fair and square. So I think it is that the lesson here is not just that Exxon made mistakes, but that doing whatever they felt they could do, it was still out of control. And the scary thing is that a year later, we're no better prepared either in Alaska or anywhere along the coast of West Coast or East Coast, the Gulf Coast of the States. We're no better prepared today than we were a year ago. And these tankers don't go aground every day, but when the next one goes ashore, goes aground, we're going to have another dreadful, dreadful, dreadful spill.
Now, you're not trying to take any of the blame off Exxon's shoulders, but you are saying in your new book that there are many others who are at fault, too. And you point, for instance, to Alyeska, the consortium of oil companies that own the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
Yes.
It was their responsibility, really, on paper, right, to take care of any oil spill?
Exactly. They made many, many public reassurances when they were trying to get a permit to build this pipeline and run these tankers up to Alaska. Reassurances that they could handle any kind of oil spill, that they would be there. In addition to all these public reassurances, Congress made them make a binding commitment that they would have a contingency plan that could handle any size of spill. This was a condition of being able to develop this oil. And they told us, they told the state of Alaska, the Coast Guard, and everybody that they were prepared. Here's our plan. We have these people. We have these boats. Well, it turns out when the spill happened that they simply were not prepared. They weren't out there within an hour or two as they were supposed to. It took them 9 hours to get their first boat out to the tanker. And then their equipment wasn't working, and it was clearly beyond them. Meanwhile, the consortium of Alyeska was trying to hand off the spill as quickly as possible and as quietly as possible so the public didn't see, to Exxon. So Exxon was flying up from Texas, scrambling, and I think in many instances the Exxon people did whatever they could and tried their hardest to contain the oil. But here, they're trying to mount a response from thousands of miles away. They're flying into Valdez. Where am I going to stay tonight? Where's a phone? Where's this? Where's that? And they're trying to control an oil spill, which really is like a house on fire. You know, you can't sit around debating how you're going to attack it, how you're going to solve the problem. You have to immediately be on it.
Well, the picture that you paint is of all these groups, including the state government and the federal government, Exxon, Alyeska, all wondering, well, who's going to take responsibility for this? Who has authority here? And everybody's slowing down everybody else since no one stood up to take responsibility right away.
It was chaotic and confusing. And one of the things, which has to a certain extent been covered up, is that the federal government, our own government, is supposed to be prepared to step in and clean up any kind of oil spill anywhere, anytime, if the spiller is not responsible or if the spill is too large for them. In this case, in those early days, there was a lot of debate behind the scenes as to whether the government should federalize the spill, take it over. Unfortunately, our own government was less prepared than Exxon. One admiral confided that it would take the government 2 weeks just to set up the paperwork to begin hiring people and leasing equipment. And by then, you know, it was totally out of control. So the spill was like a hot potato. Nobody really wanted it. Alyeska threw it up in the air and sort of tossed it at Exxon. The federal government did not want to federalize it. They didn't have the money. They didn't have the equipment. They didn't have the procedures to do what they were supposed to do and, you know, step in and stand behind an oil company. And so Exxon was left with what proved to be an impossible task.
What about the state government in Alaska? You say they were reluctant to take action because they didn't want to be sued if anything went wrong.
That's right. Behind the scenes, there was this tremendous concern for, well, if we tell Exxon to do this, it may come back to haunt us in court. If we begin cleaning up ourselves, we may be accused of interfering. And it was behind the scenes, there was this tremendous concern that if the state did all these different things that some of the people wanted to do, that they wouldn't be able to have as strong a suit and collect as much money in court from Exxon. And you know, the state's role in this is very, very disturbing to me. Now, I've been an Alaskan for 25 years, and I love the state, and I love Alaskans, and I'm an Alaskan myself. But the fact is, over the years, we've enjoyed tremendous wealth and many benefits of oil, building our schools, our highways. There's even a program where each Alaskan gets something like $800 just free money each year from our oil revenues. But while we've had all these benefits, we've barely put any money at all into oil, protecting our environment and our communities from oil spills and from other environmental problems.
You know, in addition to being an environmental tragedy, the oil spill was also an oil public relations problem for the companies involved with the Alaska pipeline. Do you think that the public relations end of this helped in the cleanup process, or do you think it put energy into projects that weren't really going to pay off environmentally but would look good superficially?
Well, I think the public relations aspect of the spill are fascinating and also terrifying. I think that, I mean, Exxon obviously poured a lot of effort and money into trying to save its public image, trying to portray that the spill was not as bad as it was, there wasn't as much death and destruction. They sent out little brochures to their cardholders and stockholders and so on and so forth. A lot of baloney. But Exxon also made some very serious mistakes with public relations. I think one of the most fundamental mistakes Exxon made was that their top people, their people that work in the glass towers in New York and so forth, did not come to Alaska, did not walk those beaches, get oil on their hands, pick up some dead birds, and see the fear and the sense of helplessness in the face of Alaskans. If they had sensitized themselves, I think that they would have made a lot of more careful and better decisions on how to manage the cleanup, how to work with Alaskans, and how to and perhaps have been more committed to the cleanup. They also would have gotten some good public relations out of it. But ironically, their top person in Alaska, Frank Irasi, who responded that first morning and flew up to Alaska, within 2 weeks, he had begun to earn respect of some of the Alaskans who were most affected, some of the fishermen, the Coast Guard people, and because he seemed to care and he seemed to be trying to do whatever he could to, you know, lessen the damage. After 2 weeks, Exxon pulled him out. Now, the official reason was that he was exhausted, he needed to go prepare for hearings. But it's my speculation that Exxon wanted somebody in charge there who would be able to, you know, hold a tougher company line. And so they brought somebody who had been in Australia, and they continued to manage the spill, the cleanup, from thousands of miles away. That's where the people were who were making the key decisions.
What's at stake for the oil companies? What do they stand to lose because of the bad PR from the oil spill?
Well, as one oil company executive put it in one word, he said, the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. They want to drill in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, and they were on track to get Congress to open it up for them and until the spill happened and showed that they're totally unprepared to handle large spills.
Exxon poured a lot of money into Alaska during the cleanup, and you say that some of the people in Alaska ended up becoming spillionaires. I mean, they ended up making making money from the spill.
Yes.
How did that work? Who actually made money from it?
Well, you know, this spill brought out the best in some people and perhaps the worst in others. There were people in Alaska, people from all over the country that flew in there and said, look, I'm here to help. I'm going to volunteer. You don't have to pay me. I want to save some birds. If I save one otter, it's worth it. I'll work all summer to save one animal. There were other people who managed to get hired and looked at the spill as a chance to get rich. Many people, Alaskans who were being hired or were offered these jobs, also felt that they were being bought off. They were being paid. Some people were being paid a tremendous amount of money, and when you're being paid a lot of money, very often you're tempted not to talk against your boss, the person, don't bite the hand that feeds you. Some fishermen in the early days were hired, paid a lot of money to just go out there and park your boat. We don't have anything for you to do right now. Get out of sight and don't talk to anybody about what you see.
You've worked with Native communities in Alaska. What affected the spill and all the people coming up for the cleanup have on life for Natives in Alaska?
Well, of course, many Native people in Alaska live in villages far away from Prince William Sound and were not directly impacted. But there were quite a few villages in Prince William Sound and on down the coast towards Kodiak, which are small villages, maybe a couple of hundred people. And these people live there because traditionally and still today, they're tied to the ocean. They do a lot of fishing, they do a lot of hunting, and they depend on the sea. It's their source of life. So when the spill came and the oil washed onto their shores, one of the most frustrating things and painful things for them was that nobody could tell them for sure what was safe to eat and what wasn't, or if they would ever be able to fish again and eat the clams and eat the mussels. And it was just like the death of the world to them. Now, probably as the years go on, it's going to be safe for them to fish and to collect clams and mussels and so forth again. But how soon? They're not sure. And certainly last year they lived with this terrible uncertainty.
My guest is Art Davidson, and he's an Alaskan who's written about land and wildlife there. And his new book is called In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, The Devastating Impact of the Alaska Oil Spill. Would you or anyone else in Alaska want to return to life before the Trans-Alaska Pipeline? It just seems to me that Alaskans have paid a really tragic price for the oil, but I think a lot of Alaskans feel that over the years they had many benefits from it.
Oh, that's right. You know, today, and over the last years since Prudhoe Bay has come online, something like 80% of our state budget is funded from oil revenues.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people's jobs tied into it. And so Alaska has been, in a sense, you know, tied in a sense, bought off by the oil industry a long time ago. Now, there are individual Alaskans who, and myself included, would be happy to go back to those days, live without Prudhoe Bay, live without all the boom and bust economy that the oil has created, and also do without some of the benefits. I think most Alaskans, however, and this is, of course, what has played out, we're addicted to that oil money.
What safety standards would you like to see to prevent another disastrous oil spill?
I'd like to see the Coast Guard well-funded so that they can really do their job of guarding our shores. I'd like to see the oil industry be required to have double-hulled tankers. I'd like to see the liability laws set so that each state can require full liability of an oil company if it causes a spill like this. I'd like to see the industry know that if it causes damage, it's going to have to do its very, very, very best to rectify the damage and pay for the damages. And I'd like to see us begin to wean ourselves from such a wasteful use of energy. You know, we're such a wasteful society. I'm not talking about stopping our use of cars tomorrow, abandoning our cars and walking to work, but finding more fuel-efficient cars, finding many, many ways that exist to use less energy. Therefore, we'll rely on, we don't have such a heavy reliance on shipping oil to our cities, and which in turn creates more pollution. So I think there are many things we can do. Another very, very fascinating and important effort is just growing, and that is what's called the Valdez Principles. And this is being developed both by environmentalists and some environmentally aware corporations, and it's a sort of a Ten Commandments, if you will, for industry to adopt, saying, and if a company will sign on, they'll be saying, look, we're going to do our best to be environmentally responsible, be energy efficient, and we'll even provide an audit each year of our company's activities to show what progress we're making. So the Valdez Principles is something that industry can take on to do their job, to sort of develop a corporate consciousness, to develop a method to watch how they're doing business.
During our conversation, you've talked about things that went wrong during the cleanup and people and organizations and companies that avoided responsibility. Were there heroes? Do you think of there as being any heroes?
There were. There were heroes. There were individuals on every side of this crisis who worked very hard within the Coast Guard, within the state government, within Exxon. I think that Exxon did do some things well. One of the untold stories, or barely known stories from the spill, is that we could have had three times, four times as much oil out there in the water. That was the oil remaining in the ship. That ship almost dislodged itself from the reef. And had it dislodged itself, the nautical engineers tell us that it very likely would have capsized, broken apart, and all that oil would have gotten out there. Exxon did a good job of getting that oil off and onto another tanker. They call it lightering. And they did a good job at that. So I think there were heroes. There were individuals who worked their heart out and did some good. A lot of the volunteers who came up and tried to save the sea otters and the birds. No, they didn't save thousands and thousands of birds, but they saved individual birds and individual creatures. They showed that they cared. They made a little difference. And so I think those people were real heroic.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Art Davidson's new book is In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, The Devastating Impact of the Alaska Oil Spill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.